Support for today's broadcast comes from the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Illinois, hosting a lifelong learning program developed specifically for adults over 50. Additional information on programs available by email at olli@uiuc.edu.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. When we enter a dark room, we turn on the lights. We expect to have light anytime we want it. We also have all manner of other devices that are powered by electricity. We take electricity for granted until it goes out. Then we're stuck in the dark. How is our power delivered? What happens when the lights go out? On the program today, we're going to take a look at the grid, how it was built, how it grew, and its vulnerabilities today. We'll also talk about how the grid has shaped American society, from building design to how we spend our evenings. Our guest is a physicist and science writer. His name is Philip Shuey. He is the author of The Grid, A Journey Through the Heart of Our Electrified World. Philip Shuey has a Ph.D. in particle physics, an alum of the University of Illinois. He's taken part in work exploring the inner structure of protons at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory in Batavia, Illinois. He is currently chief science writer at the American Institute of Physics, a member of the American Physical Society and the National Association of Science Writers. He's also a member of the Dramatists Guild. His book, The Grid, A Journey Through the Heart of Our Electrified World, is published by the Joseph Henry Press. Philip, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thanks.
The grid surrounds us, but we don't think of it very often at all. Where do we start to understand what the grid is?
Well, it's like a fish being in water. The fish doesn't realize he's immersed in water until he's thrown out of it. And we generally, as you said, don't recognize how important the grid is until it's turned off. But everywhere you turn, you're either plugging a cell phone into the grid or you're turning on a television or a light bulb. Wherever you are right now, in your car, except if you're in the middle of a national park, you're probably within a couple of feet of the electrical grid at its farthest extent.
Yeah. Now, you compare the workings of the grid to some of the functions of our bodies, the skeleton, the nervous system, digestive system, immune system, and so on. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, it's almost as if the grid were alive. It has a human beings eat food, and the electrical grid, at least at the power plant level, consumes fuel. We have an allergic system. When we have cold viruses into our body, our noses make mucus, and there are plenty of reactionary effects set off. So the same thing happens to the grid when there's a disturbance or a lightning strike. If an appliance is taking too much power, a circuit breaker switch flips and out goes that appliance. There are ways that the grid defends itself just as the human body defends itself. The human body has a nerve center. It's the human brain. And the grid also has a nerve center, the control center, where power is distributed over a wide area and even a continental level. In category after category, then, the human body and the grid seem to have a lot in common.
Yeah. Have you ever experienced a sustained loss of electricity?
Yes. I live in the Washington, D.C. area, and one summer, about 2 months apart, we were out of power once for about 6 days, and then a few months later, we were out of power for 5 days.
Wow.
And it's not as though these were extraordinary conditions, just a severe thunderstorm in the one case. Most of our power lines are above ground, and whenever a mighty wind comes along, it seems that something goes down, and a number of factors just kept us without power for that whole length of time. almost a week, and ice cubes are, fortunately, it was in the summer, not the winter, so we weren't freezing. Our pipes weren't freezing, but it was difficult to grapple with.
Yeah, it's okay for a day or two, but
The
novelty wears off quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That happens in many blackouts. I devote a lot of attention to the enormous northeastern blackouts in 1965, and then again in practically the same area in the year 2003, 30 million people and then 50 million people lost power. And one of the interesting aspects of that kind of event is that it's very annoying. It's potentially life-threatening for some people, but it's like having a huge snowstorm. It sort of brings people together, too, and it certainly alters the rules and the way we relate to each other. You break out the candles, and it can be romantic or kind of fun for a couple hours. And I've imagined what it would be like if we turned the power off once a month like that, just to see what it would be like. And I don't think people would like it. If it happens every couple of years, maybe, it's sort of fun. But even then, it's annoying also.
Yeah, once the novelty wears off, it's not fun at all, especially if it's particularly cold outside.
Yeah.
Which happened here in the Champaign-Urbana area some years ago when we had an ice storm in February. Mm. It was quite cold. When did people begin to play with electricity, and when did they realize it could be harnessed?
Well, electricity, or at least electric and magnetic things, have been known since antiquity. And then in the 1700s, we knew enough about it so that it was sort of a parlor game. You could crank a machine which would store up charge, rub charge off of various fabrics, and as a sort of parlor game, you could hold hands, 5 or 6 or 10 people together, and provide little shocks for each other. But it wasn't until the 1800s when electricity was first used, partly to discover new elements, and then as the first electrical industry, you might say, was a telegraph, where you could send messages tens of miles in just a few seconds. That was a revelation for armies and governments and business leaders up and down the East Coast of America, for instance. Now, the grid that we now know, and that the grid I'm writing about, the big infrastructure that supplies energy to homes and buildings everywhere, that began as a gleam in the eye of Thomas Edison,
mm-hmm.
who was already a famous inventor, one of the most famous men in the country for having invented the phonograph and an improved version of telegraph. But then it dawned on him. He went to the lab of another inventor who had clattering machines and generators and was mightily trying to develop a lighting system of his own. And Edison saw this, and then something clicked in his head, and he felt that he could do it much better than anybody else. He was working on a better light bulb at that time, and he succeeded in inventing a light bulb. But then he went farther than that. He created the whole system that you plug the light bulb into. Not only lighting, but he also foresaw that running motors and other electrical devices would transform society, and it did.
Yeah. What you describe as the morning of the grid was the year 1880. The wee hours were at Menlo Park, and then dawn broke, if I could continue on that metaphor, in Manhattan. What did Edison provide in New York?
He, as I said, the gleam, the inspiration to create the system in the first place, that was a terrific innovation. And no less important were two or three other properties or qualities that he had. One was the ability to lead a large research team, and the researchers, the lab he constructed at Menlo Park, was unique for its day and really unprecedented that a private company should devote so much money and talent to inventing things. It was an invention factory, it's been called. Another of his great properties, beside leadership and inventiveness, was sheer persistence. I believe it was Edison who came up with that marvelous formula that everything I did was 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. But he attracted loyalty, and here was another crucial ingredient. He attracted investments. He went to the Wall Street financier and got the money he needed. He raised something like $500,000, which was a lot of money. It's a lot of money now, but particularly a lot of money in the year 1880.
Yeah.
And J.P. Morgan was the main investor, and Edison went to work, planned his invasion of New York as if it were the Normandy invasion, and he arrived, set up shop, and built himself the world's first grid.
Now, when did electricity begin to become a dependable service?
At first, it was just something for rich people, and this continued for some years, a couple of decades anyway, the 1880s and 1890s. It started showing up more and more at fancy places like inaugurations and swear-ins and movie theaters and rich hotels and world's fairs. But it wasn't until after 1900, especially in the 1920s, when the price of electricity came down enough that ordinary folks could start thinking of getting it. It really was a luxury until then. You continued to use gas light. Sometimes even if you had electricity coming into your home, you still kept it in reserve. It was sort of a fancy thing, like the fancy dinner plates that you would bring out only on Sunday when you were entertaining, that you would turn on an electric light. At other times, you would just use the ordinary gas light or maybe even candles. But it was 1920s, I think, was the crucial year where you could say that by the end of the 1920s, a majority, maybe a small majority, but a majority of American homes had electricity.
Mm. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is Philip Shuey. He is the author of The Grid, A Journey Through the Heart of Our Electrified World. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting to talk with us in Champaign on line four. Good afternoon.
Hi, thank you. I think you'd be remiss without giving Nikola Tesla credit for the grid, probably more so than Edison. Edison actually, Tesla invented alternating current and attempted mightily to promote it. And Edison didn't like alternating current. He fought it. He was in favor of direct current. If we still had direct current, we wouldn't have any grid. We'd have thousands of separate little generating plants with a very short range. So please give Mr. Tesla the credit he is due.
We will do that.
Oh, certainly, Tesla is one of the great geniuses, scientific genius and technological geniuses of all time, and he does get a fair play in my book. As you say, Tesla actually was an employee of Mr. Edison for a while, and the two of them had many arguments over which was better, alternating current, where the current sloshes back and forth, or direct current. And Edison was dead sure that the direct current, DC current, was vastly superior. And Tesla and he parted ways. Tesla's great masterstroke was to not only to design a system of alternating current generators and circuits, but he integrated electricity and motors. Motors weren't the first thing in people's minds when they thought of electricity in the 1880s, the early 1880s. The number one thing was lighting, to provide light for buildings and factories. But very quickly it became apparent that somehow we had to make motors work too electrically. And it was Tesla's multi-circuit design that made all the difference. And Tesla made his name not with working with Mr. Edison, but with teaming up with Westinghouse, and to establish a whole series of alternating current grids in cities in America and then in Europe and other places.
Yeah, and tell us a little bit about George Westinghouse.
George Westinghouse was one of those great invention barons, sort of like Thomas Edison, but where Edison was flamboyant and very quotable and in the news all the time, Westinghouse was a very private man. But like Edison and Tesla, the three of these, I would say, were the first generation of the great grid geniuses and heroes of the grid. Westinghouse just stuck to his guns, quietly, out of the public eye, a little bit like Bill Gates, or other financiers who remain behind the scenes. He built one company after another, and he bought out other companies. But he had what Tesla and Edison also had, vision that he could see. You have to see into the future what the thing you're making, what it will do to America. And, yes, he wanted to make money. All these gentlemen wanted to make money. But I think these three guys especially had in mind the transforming effect that they were about to have on society. And it did come to pass.
Yeah. Now, Edison, Tesla, and Westinghouse are familiar names to us. And there's another name. There's another individual I'd like you to talk about. He was unknown to me, Samuel Insull, and he was the man responsible for electrifying Chicago. So tell us about him and the role he played in the growth of the grid.
Yeah, one of the more fun aspects of writing this book was discovering and then writing about some of these unsung heroes of the grid. And Samuel Insull is maybe the most important of the second generation of grid builders. He was a lieutenant of Edison, and he was working with Edison at his right hand for much of the time. And when Edison built the first grid in New York City, many other cities saw how successful it was and wanted a grid of their own. And Edison began building a factory to build thousands and thousands of parts that could be shipped to these grids. Insull, even though he was only in his early 20s, was entrusted with this task. So he, to a certain degree, even helped to build Edison's own grid. But then he moved to Chicago, and at the age of 30 started building his own empire there in Chicago and Illinois. And I devote a whole chapter just to the building up of the electrical grid in Chicago, which in the 1920s was the most electrified place in the world. What Insull did was to sort of transform how electricity was sold, how it was marketed, the kinds of machines that were used. For instance, the large generators in use before his time were the sort of piston-driven generators that looked sort of like the wheels, the crankshaft on the side of locomotives, steam locomotives, the back and forth. At that time, around 1905, there were better designs, which he helped to champion. And at first, other grid manufacturers didn't want to build these new machines called steam turbines, but Insull stuck to his guns. He wanted the largest generator in the world, and he got it, even though he had to pay for part of it with his own money. Within 4 or 5 years, just about every other grid in the country had what he had. He was also a master of finance in producing new forms of loans that investors could safely invest in utilities. Utility stocks became very highly respected. The profits were always paid on time. He was just a master of public relations. He got a little too close to various politicians in the late 1920s and early 1930s, and this eventually became his undoing when the crash of 1929 brought his big empire down. The story of the fall of Samuel Insull is a little like the fall of Enron. Insull himself was indicted on many charges of stock fraud, but he was exonerated. He was acquitted on all the charges.
What an interesting story. Now, how did electrification, how did that begin to change life in the Windy City, and how quickly did life change in the Windy City with the introduction of electricity into the majority of homes in the Chicago area?
It happened slowly at first. As I say, in the 1890s, it was mostly rich folks that had electricity. But Insull's game plan was always to reduce, whenever he could, reduce the cost of electricity and eventually make it so cheap that you just had to have it. One way of doing this was to build larger generators. Another was to start bringing utensils, electrified things, into the home. And one sales gimmick that he tried was to go through neighborhoods and crying out that if you, madam, would bring your flat irons out to our cart here, our truck, and if you agree to accept electric service for a year, we will give you a free electric iron. So if we can say that the first electrified item in the home was electric lights, the second big mass market electrical item in the house, so it wasn't refrigerators, it was the electric iron. Now, why should that make such a big difference? Again, we don't notice it, or at least many men don't notice it. If women are doing the ironing in the home, what a backbreaking job it is. You have to heat these heavy irons and transport them from the hot stove over to the ironing board. Whereas with an electric iron, the iron doesn't have to leave the ironing board, and you don't have to heat up hundreds of pounds of wood in the course of a week to do the ironing.
Yeah.
The third big electrified item, which came in only in the 1920s, was the invention of the radio.
Yay.
And this was truly not just a labor-saving device. In fact, the radio is not much of a labor-saving device, but it is a cultural-altering device. And as I like to think, the evening entertainment, which often consisted of the daughter of the family playing a piano in the evening to entertain her family, a lot of that went out when the radio came along, because it was very easy just to gather around the radio and hear someone else play the piano, or a baseball game played somewhere else, or a polka band from 500 miles away. That's how electricity, in a sort of sneaky way, starts to change culture. And it's the sort of thing we didn't notice or wouldn't have noticed until many years afterwards.
Yeah. And also with electricity, we can have the elevator. And that brings us change in how buildings are designed.
That's right. A large city like New York or Chicago, these two cities, Chicago is the second city after all, they were always battling to get higher and higher up into the sky. If you've got a good bedrock to build a city on, as New York and Chicago do, and real estate price is so high, it behooves you to go up rather than out. And Chicago was a pioneer in elevator design, and a big part of that was the ability of electricity and Tesla's motors, which labored away in the basement to raise people 10, 20, 30, 40 stories, and now you've got the Sears Tower.
Yeah. And one of the places you don't want to be when the electricity goes out, though, is in an elevator.
Yes, it can be quite claustrophobic. It's happened to me once or twice. I provide a couple of anecdotes about that in the book, especially the 2003 blackout, which occurred only a couple of years after the events of 9/11. And many very terrifying. It's terrifying to be in an elevator to begin with, but if you've got in your mind the idea that not only is the elevator stopped, but the whole building's coming down any minute, it's terrorism squared.
Yeah. Well, I remember that afternoon of August 14th, 2003, in the newsroom here, we had these images of people walking out of buildings and across bridges, and you wondered, what has happened?
Yeah, yeah. That's all you can do is in a city like New York is evacuate Manhattan. Now the events of the August 2003 blackout weren't anything remotely like the events of 9/11, but it still represents an example of a great civic emergency. Not a lot of lives were lost that day, but basically half the people in Manhattan have to get out somehow, and the best way to do it is streaming across bridges, or just spending the night in Central Park.
Oh. Now, how does that blackout compare with a blackout many people will remember from the 1960s, November 9th, 1965?
Yeah, these two blackouts are remarkably similar in the way that they began and in the areas through which they propagated, upstate New York, New York City, Toronto. I like to think, a lot of electrons running through the same wires were present in the 1965 blackout and the 2003 blackouts. I sort of see it as Act 1 and Act 2 as this grand electrical drama. And in each case, a very small thing, just a single wire, the electricity flowing in a single high-voltage wire, caused the power line to go down and for the power to have to shift to neighboring lines, and these neighboring lines in turn weren't up to the task. And very quickly after that, in both cases, 1965 and 2003, there was very quickly, in a matter of minutes, a huge cascade effect propagating from state to state to state, from city to city to city, and very quickly tens of millions of people were without power.
And across an international border.
And across, in both cases, yeah. Canada was involved. In the case of the 1965 blackout, both blackouts were huge, but I like to think that the 65 blackout came as an even bigger shock to the system because nobody had thought that a blackout, this huge civic technology disaster, could be as big as it was. So it was sort of the Pearl Harbor of electricity, this huge thing that you weren't expecting suddenly arrived, and it was a shock. 2003 blackout was even a bit bigger, but I think by then people were more used to it, and if not exactly complacent, they could at least say, well, yeah, I mean, why is this happening? It's annoying. But it didn't come as a great shock or as much of a shock.
Now, following a big outage, a big blackout, is there some review of what went wrong and how to prevent it from happening again?
Oh, certainly. There's always, first of all, the blame game, and then after when sober minds take over, the main thing we want to do, that society wants to do, is, all right, let's not blame anybody. Let's just find out what went wrong and see to it that it doesn't happen again. And in the case of the 2003 blackout, that was the first question. If the same blackout happened in 65, why did it happen again in 03? And even though there are many more watchdog organizations looking over the shoulder of grid operators, and even though there are many more transmission lines and more state-of-the-art electronics, it did happen again. And in the wake of the 2003 blackout, there was naturally a Canadian and American official government review. There is also an industry-wide watchdog group, the North American Electric Reliability Council, which has since been upgraded to a sort of federal entity itself. Believe it or not, the reliability measures, you know, how much extra power you had to have, a lot that a utility had to have ready in case of an emergency, some of that was voluntary. And even if you're well-meaning, a utility, you may not do quite as good a job as you should be doing. But now that for one thing has changed, that these rules, reliability standards, are now mandatory, and if you fail to measure up, you can be fined heavily. Some of the problems in the 2003 blackout were just poor judgment on the part of humans. Some of the security software that should have been watching out for downed lines. Some of the software, some of these computers were off that day, which should never happen. Certain backup systems weren't backing up. So there are a lot of problems that day, August 14th, 2003, that we have since discovered. But if you asked me, could such a blackout happen again, or maybe even bigger, the answer would have to be yes.
Is it fair to say, then, that the bigger the grid gets, the more we rely on it, the more assumptions we make about how it is protected, the harder the fall?
Yes, that's a fair assessment. It's useful to earlier I compared the electrical grid to a human body in many ways. One could also compare the electrical grid to a number of naturally occurring complex systems. And by that I mean a system which is composed of many parts, rapidly interacting parts, systems, and I don't mean just machines. I'm referring by complex system, I mean also things like hurricanes and river systems that suffer certain floods every 10 years or 20 years or 50 years, or earthquake systems, fault lines. An earthquake system, the San Andreas Fault in California, can go for years and years and years without a large earthquake. That doesn't mean that you're safe. In fact, it might mean the opposite. It might mean that stresses are building up. in such a way that can only be released by what would then be, after many years of no earthquake, a big earthquake. The energy or the fault lines can exist in an electrical grid, too. There are things we can do to reduce the number of blackouts, but there is a near mathematical certainty that large and larger blackouts will eventually occur. The large ones happen much less often, but they will happen. And you can picture this whole complexity system as a sand pile. If you keep adding sand grains to a conically shaped sand pile, the steepness of the cone gets ever higher. And when you drop the 100th grain of sand, a small avalanche occurs. And then you can add some more grains, and the pile starts building up again. And then maybe another small avalanche occurs, and then the cone starts building itself up again. And so it may be every 100 grains a small avalanche occurs, and every 1,000 grains of sand you add to this pile, a medium-sized avalanche occurs. Well, every 100,000th grain, a large avalanche occurs that affects the whole pile of sand. Now, you couldn't have said when that 100,000th grain was added to the pile that this was it. This was going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back. You don't know which grain it will be. All you know is that as the complex pile of sand gets higher, gets steeper, that you're getting more vulnerable. Now, the whole of this applies in a metaphorical sense to the electrical grid. As we had more and more people, more and more generators, more and more wires, things that can interact very quickly with each other, we're setting ourselves up for a fall.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is physicist and science writer Philip Shuey. He's the author of The Grid, A Journey Through the Heart of Our Electrified World. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take another call. Listener on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. Something that Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute has pointed out is that in the early days, the generating plants were not terribly reliable. And by linking things together in a grid, the delivery of electricity to homes and businesses became much more reliable. But nowadays, nuclear plants possibly aside, the generating plants are very reliable, and it's the grid that is unreliable. And his suggestion is, as presented in his book, Small is Profitable, is that by designing our electricity-consuming devices more efficiently, we can get by with less electricity and have smaller generating plants based on renewables that are widely dispersed and are not linked together, and that thereby we will increase reliability a lot.
Yes, you've raised not just one, but four or five really interesting points. First, I should say, Amory Lovins is one of my heroes and one of the current generation of grid heroes. I like to think of him as a sort of Tesla of the modern age. Not that he has invented things, but he has helped us to view energy flow and the grid in different ways, energy efficiency in general. Back in the 1970s, Lovins pointed out, and Jimmy Carter took it to heart, that our whole energy policy, our approach to energy, was wrong, partly because we were building too many large generators, which, even if each generator was efficient by itself, it was still vulnerable to problems, and that when you put all of your eggs in one basket, if a grid depends on just one large generator, that's fine as long as the generator works. When it breaks down, then you're in trouble. And in the ensuing couple of decades, Lovins was a pioneer in showing us how we can save energy. He was a pioneer for the sort of light bulbs now that when people ask me how they can reduce their energy bill, that's number one on my list. Go home and replace every incandescent bulb you have in your home with a compact fluorescent light, you get the same amount of light for about one-fourth the energy. But depending on your home energy budget, you might save as much as 10 or 20% off your electricity bill. If you do that one thing alone, replace the bulbs. Yes, another of Lovins's big crusades has been to make the electrical grid, or at least the production of electricity, a smaller scale, sort of reversing history. Decades ago, it was the case that generally the larger the machine, the more efficient it was, the more electricity you would get for a pound of fuel that you used. But in the 1960s, that economy of scale stopped happening. That was sort of I compare that to Moore's Law in computer science. Moore's Law says that every 18 months or so, the amount of computing power you get out of a microchip doubles. And it was the case from the year 1900 up until about 1965 that every time you built a larger generator, you generally got more electricity per unit of fuel. But that stopped happening. And what Lovins says is that if you build small generators, nearby generators, the small generators, they break down too, but if a small one breaks down, you can always replace it with another one. As for the nearby generators, as much as 10% of electricity or energy is lost by transmitting it over hundreds of miles. What if you transmit electricity only 1 mile, or if you have something in your backyard? All of these things are coming together in a very interesting way, and as he likes to point out, in the last 30 years, the amount of energy in America needed to produce a $1 of gross domestic product has fallen almost by half. In other words, from the year 1975 to the year 2005, it takes about half as much energy to make the same amount of product as we used to. And that's really, really good news about the energy front. The bad news is that we still waste a lot of energy, and we could probably do a lot more still.
Does the listener want to follow up quickly?
I think he's done a fine job.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's take another call. Listener in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Hello. What can you tell us about the exact status of the present distribution system and planned improvements to it, if any?
Good question.
Well, we need more high-powered voltage lines. When I drive on the interstate sometimes, I try and drive as little as possible. When I do, and find myself in a traffic jam, everybody complains that, oh, why are there all these cars? And the simple, one simple answer is, if there are twice as many people, from the time I was born until now, the population of America has doubled. And what I like to ask is, yeah, nobody likes being in a traffic jam. Nobody likes having a power line in his backyard. But if you have twice as many people, you're going to have twice as many cars, twice as many, and where are you going to put them all? So, yes, we do need more electricity. The best way to deal with all those extra people is to use the Amory Lovins method, and that is find better, efficient methods of using energy, first of all. The second thing we should do is to invest more in renewable energy sources, the kind of ways of making electricity that don't melt glaciers. But if you're specifically asking about the distribution system, the electrical lines you see across the countryside, yes, we probably need more of those. I hate to say it. Nobody likes having them in their backyard. Nobody likes paying for them, but we probably need more of them. Now, the distribution system, or transmission grid, as it's called, just the big lines that carry electricity from the generators to neighborhoods, is a tricky subject because much of the rest of the electrical industry has been deregulated in the last 10 years, but not this transmission line part of the electricity business. And this is one of the things that Congress is going to have to deal with, and I think they will this summer, how to encourage investment in more transmission lines.
Well, what is the federal regulatory agency doing to fulfill its responsibilities in that regard? Anything?
Well, even they work with the laws that Congress gives them. In the 1980s and 1990s, the generation of electricity, that part of the power business, was deregulated, and there was a sort of gold rush in the building of new and more efficient power plants. And that was a place where investment really paid off, and investment money flocked there. Either because of the basic technology or physics of it, there hasn't been a gold rush in the transmission part of the power industry, and the regulatory laws aren't there yet. Congress needs to do something about this to make the building of transmission lines a more friendly, a more profitable method, and that hasn't happened yet. And so the consequence is more and more electricity is flowing across a non-increasing amount of transmission line, and it's as if you keep all the highways, the interstate highways, the same, but you shove two or three times as many cars out there. What's going to happen? You're going to have more traffic jams.
Mm-hmm.
Congress needs to do something.
Let's take another call. A listener in Belgium, line 4. Hi.
Hello. How are you all today? Before we talk a whole lot more about investing in some very huge power transmission lines, maybe we should consider some of the aspects that Europe is beginning to deal with, and that is generating your power on your roof and using it exactly in your house and getting rid of dealing with electricity in the form of 120 or 220 single-phase usage and going to strictly 12-volt or 24-volt systems. Many of the systems that we use nowadays, computers, TVs, many, many things, don't need to have 120-volt. They can easily work on 110, on 12-volt, 6-volt, I mean, not 6-volt, but 24-volt, and be very useful in the way of using, solar systems and stuff like that. Get rid of the power system. Get rid of a lot of hassles that we have, including carbon content that we put into the environment. And Philips Corporation has already talked about a house that is very much that way. They have got motors that can easily work back with Edison's idea of direct current and generate direct current on your roof and putting it directly into your house, saving a lot of aspects.
Taking some pressure off the grid.
Exactly.
Yes, I think society is moving in that direction and should move in that direction. The cost of solar-based electricity has been coming down a lot, but it's still much more expensive than the old-fashioned fossil fuel kind. There's a point in my book where I talk about, I'm describing exactly the sort of energy-efficient home you just mentioned and how people were paying extra money to get wind power, green energy, in our case from West Virginia. There's not enough wind right here where I live, so you have to bring in electricity or use power made several hundred miles away, and it's too expensive to haul that energy, not that you can single out energy from any one source and send it to your house, but you can pay for the sort of a symbolic act of buying into green energy, paying a surplus, a small surcharge, for receiving or helping the development of wind power somewhere else. America is, as you suggest, is behind Europe in this, is falling behind. Denmark gets 20% of its electricity from wind power. It would be wonderful if the United States could match that, or even 10%. It's only less than 1% now, but it is growing, and maybe 20 years from now, we would have more wind power. It's going to take time, though, for that kind of renewable energy to make a big impact. It will come, but it's taking time.
Mm. There we're going to have to wrap up here pretty quickly. Is there a way to make the grid system itself, the transmission system, the delivery system, smarter?
That is a subject of pressing concern. I just got through writing an article for Scientific American magazine on the subject of smart grids, a grid that is even more intelligent or cognizant of its surroundings.
So it can feel a sneeze coming on.
Yes. It's strange that the Pentagon of all government agencies is accused of using 20 or 30 year old computers, and it's strange that the electrical grid also sort of lives in the past. When you have investment money, you build bigger power plants, and you may it's easy to neglect some of these tiny infrastructure things, just as things like computers that monitor power flowing. Why in the middle of Ohio on that day in 2003 they had the computers? That shouldn't have happened. They should have had better computers and more backup computers. There are ways of making the grid even more vigilant and self-conscious, if I can use that expression of a thing made of metal, so that these big blackouts don't happen. They are going to happen, but they'll happen less often if we make these machines more sentient.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time, unfortunately. Philip Shuey, thank you so much for talking with us this
afternoon.
Philip Shuey is the author of The Grid, A Journey Through the Heart of Our Electrified World. The book is published by the Joseph Henry Press. And let me spell our guest's name for you this afternoon. S-C-H-E-W-E. And that interview from the Afternoon Magazine archives, it was conducted on March 22nd of this year. You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. And settlement prices are in from Kansas City and from Chicago, and it was quite a wild day. Here to tell us what happened today in the end, Todd Gleason. He has settlement prices for us, Todd.
Another wild ride, both in Kansas City and Chicago today. Kansas City wheat has really been the market that's been moving things higher. On idea that the wheat condition will deteriorate there. That mostly based on a lot of rainfall during the hard red winter wheat harvest, which delays the harvest, and the wheat doesn't stand so well. And that pushed the marketplace in Kansas City up nearly the limit at the end of the day, just a half cent off the limit, which is 30. And they were up 29.5 in the July contract. The harvest month at 589 today, the low at 556. Their settlement price up 29.5 at 588.5. Once again, nearly the limit higher in nearby July wheat from Kansas City at 29.5 cents higher. The July wheat in Chicago following suit, 25 cents higher there. 5.95 the high, the low at 560.5. Settlement price at $5.65. They're up 25 for the day. September 6.10 1/4 the high, the low at 75.5. Settlement price at 605. They're up 24 3/4. And December futures are 19.5 cents higher today. 613. The settlement price for the soft red in Chicago December contract with a high of 18.5 and a low at $5.87. 587 in the December. The high at 618.5. March futures 621 1/4. The high. The low at 597. Settlement price at $6.18. They were up 17. And May futures $6.11 the high, the low at 595 3/4, 607 settlement price up 7 cents. July corn futures 406.5 the high, the low at 389.5 settlement price at 404.5 up 11 cents. And September futures 414 1/4 the high, the low at 398 settlement price at 412.5. They're up a dime for the day. December contract 416 3/4 the high, the low at 401 1/4 settlement price at 415 up 9.5 cents. In the March contract.